that you come from, yeah. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. Let us go and introduce the group to you, and we'll get started. A reminder, you can always join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. WAMC's Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm fine, dear friend, and all the other dear friends that we have out there. And thank you for asking, and I'll just be sitting here waiting to say something or another.
Excellent. Well, we welcome you and glad you're there to say something. Senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator, Judith Enk. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you here. Thank you very much for being with us. Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti joins us as well. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, everyone.
And we have a newbie with us. We are pleased to welcome Jennifer Burns to the program. She is a professor in the African American Studies Department at UAlbany. Dr. Burns, welcome to the program. How are you?
I am good. Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to this conversation.
Well, it's a delight to welcome you and to have you with us this morning. Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the program. We welcome your thoughts as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And let us get started and talk about what is happening. We begin with the updates on George Floyd. The violence is easing, curfews are relaxed, but the push for change does continue. There was a 10th night of protests following a somber memorial yesterday. Thousands of demonstrators poured into streets across the nation, marching over the Brooklyn Bridge and gathering outside City Hall in Seattle. As violence eases and curfews are relaxed, still, the call is for change. The Reverend Al Sharpton, who gave a eulogy for Mr. Floyd, pledged that his death would be a catalyst for change after video showed a white police officer, kneeling on Mr. Floyd's neck for almost 9 minutes as he lay face down and handcuffed on the pavement, saying, "I can't breathe." The tragedy, Mr. Sharpton said, was also a symbolic message: get your knee off our necks. The tone at many protests on Thursday was largely mournful. After more than a week of crowds burning with grief and anger over the deaths of Mr. Floyd and other Black Americans, that have spurred calls for criminal justice reform. Fueling the anguish on Thursday, an investigator in the death of Ahmaud Arbery, a Black man who was fatally shot while being chased by three white men in suburban Georgia, said one of the suspects had used a racial slur after the shooting. So, it's been quite a week, and we've been talking about this story for more than a week, for almost 2 weeks, actually. So, Jennifer, let us begin with you of your thoughts of where we are right now and what this week has meant.
I really believe that we are, you know, where we need to be to see some change happen. This is the same week, 100 years ago, of the Tulsa uprising, and so many other events in the history of America concerning injustice when it comes to African Americans has been something that has evolved and has continued over time. And I think right now what we're seeing is, you know, that next generation of people who've come up reaping the benefits of some of what, you know, the generation in the 1950s and 60s, of course, achieved, but their reality is one in which they've been promised, you know, that those civil rights acts and all of the things were implemented. And what they are experiencing is that they are not. And so that reality is really on the forefront here. And more and more Americans are able to see it because of the shutdown that we have been in. African Americans have seen this and experienced it for a very long time. So I think this slowdown is really bringing it to the forefront for others to actually see how often this happens and how long it has been going on.
Judith?
Well, I agree with Dr. Burns and also welcome her to this discussion. I think this is such a historic moment. There will be books and books written about this. And I think Americans, white Americans like me, are getting a much closer look at modern police policy in our country. The great irony is George Floyd died because of police brutality. And yet I'm comfortably sitting home watching these peaceful protests and watching the police beat the crap out of people, seemingly often for no reason, because they're breaking curfew, which seems a little ridiculous. It makes you wonder if the police are being so brutal in Lafayette Park in Washington, in Buffalo last night, where I hope we'll talk about this 75-year-old man shoved to the ground. If you haven't seen that video, you should. This is really speaking to what kind of society do we want to be? And do we not only tolerate, but fund this police culture that certainly has not respected the rights of Black and brown people for years. But this culture is just making a terrible tragedy worse and spotlighting the reforms that need to happen. So I think matching up these incredible peaceful protests happening all over the world, not just in the US in response to George Floyd's death, but how you match that up with very significant policy reform, that's going to be the next chapter.
Alan?
Well, there's not much to add to the very important things that have been said here, and I'm learning as I listen, but it seems to me that the one mistake we can't make here is to think that the police are acting in a vacuum. The police are a manifestation, in my mind, of the society, which is racist, and they know it. So they've got unions to protect them. They've got politicians who are scared of them and who deal with them from a point of view that they are powerful. But I think to say that it's a police matter ignores the entire sociology of what we have.
Right. It is. It's much more than that. Jennifer, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah. You know, I've really been thinking about just the last few days in how to present a different framework for people to see it. And, you know, to speak to Judith's point and to so many others about the policing and this kind of militarization of that, and then connecting it to culture. When we look at, say, the Ahmaud Arbery case, that is not done or was not done at the hands of the police.
Right.
It was, you know, maybe a former cop, but others involved. And it was a citizen's arrest. That means it is not the police on hand, right? When you look at what happened to George Floyd and so many others like him, when they encounter the police, those are two different exchanges. And that really helps to tease out that intersection here where we're talking about normal citizens, where it's been normalized that people can enforce their own kind of justice versus when people come in contact with the police and you see this excessive force, right? And so I think looking at how this has spread throughout a culture of policing of Black and brown people by the police, but then also by other citizens, we see the disparity here in how really interlocking systems are that reinforce each other, that go beyond just policing.
Right. Interlocking systems. Aaron.
So... no, that's an excellent point. So I think we kind of have the perfect storm here of, you know, the virus and its effects and the economic fallout and its effects. And both of those have shown what a lot of us know has been going on a long time, and that is the extremely unequal outcomes and just outright biases and discrimination, particularly for African Americans. And I think all of this is coming to a boiling point, and you know, I don't want to overstate this, but it seems like given the how sustained the protests have been, and now that they seem to be becoming more organized, we're kind of at a fork in the road in terms of which way society can go, and that is more egalitarian or more autocratic. And I'm really hoping that the dial tilts towards more egalitarian. Milton Friedman, a very famous economist, said, never waste a good crisis. And this crisis of, you know, public health economics is certainly one in which people can advocate for progressive change. And it's very heartening to see the protests not only becoming less violent, but also continuing.
On that point, Jennifer, when it comes to the protests, how do you think they will go on? And what, I guess the more important question is, how would you like to see them go on that can truly foster change as we work through this?
You know, I think the important thing is for people to not, one, I think they should go on, and I think that they should take on additional forms. Marching and parading is very important, and being visible is very important, but I also think extending conversations and seeing that as a continued way to protest and build networks between different communities in different places is something that, you know, we always say needs to go on, but we need to have it be built in a way where it's incorporating people who typically go back, as Dr. King said years ago, to business as usual, right? After the marching stops or after the visibility stops, people then return to their regular day of work. And I think now what we're seeing is the protest needs to expand more into including people in conversations where they become educated and they can do, even if it's just an individual protest, at a place that they work. Getting involved in library conversations, reading books, going out and finding out and really looking at how different systems are impacting people differently. Keeping that stream going is also part of the protest.
One of the things that that struck me as you were talking about this, Judith, of what happened in Buffalo last night. And you know, I wonder what impact those kind of things will have as the protests continue, even if they're peaceful. But we look at the majority of them being peaceful. But when you look at, here's what I don't get. So I'll put this out there, and then this is you can all help me understand this. But like, if not now, that the police understand that mm-hmm. they are under a watchful eye, mm-hmm. and yes. not to screw up. It just seems inconceivable that things like that happen, and yet we are hearing stories from around the country of people who are taking video of how they were treated at various rallies, and of course the extreme case of what happened in Buffalo. Judith?
Yeah, I was thinking exactly that for the last few days, Joe. If this is how a large number of police act when they know they are on a national stage and everyone has a camera pointed to them, what's it like when they're in a home with one person or two people and the camera isn't rolling? And the other reason why I'm so fixated on this tragic video involving the 75-year-old man in Buffalo who's on the ground bleeding from his head, a white man, is one police officer shoved him down. The rest of the police just kept walking around him. One officer stopped, presumably to offer support, and was told to keep moving, and he just then kept moving. I think that video is an illustration of police culture that we need to deal with. Police chiefs are appointed typically by mayors. Mayors are elected. Police chiefs need to make the case for their budgets. There's a strong grassroots movement now called Defund the Police. I don't think we exist as a society without a police presence. I do question why police budgets are so high and they're not investing in things like skills to de-escalate situations. And of course, you just have to look at all of the military tanks on the streets of American cities to start looking at the militarization of our domestic police force. A lot of issues here. They're complicated and we have to figure them out.
Absolutely. Alan?
You know, it seems to me that when we're asked to give money to a fire department, we do because we want to make sure that if our house gets on fire, that they'll be there. I think there's a certain amount of that with police also. Now, I think Judith is right on the money. This is a matter of character. Who are recruited to be on a police force? Who wants to be on a police force? Do they rank high on what we used to call the fascist test? Somebody who, you know, is interested, is an authoritarian down to their shoes and therefore want to be there. And it's a matter of character. What kind of character do people have? If you get a bully who's on a police force, and we've all seen them, you get a bully on a police force, let me tell you right now, it's going to be hard to change that bully's character no matter how much discussion there is. And that's what's so upsetting about this.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters and your thoughts on the subject at hand. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. WAMC's Alan Chartok joins us, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, and former EPA regional administrator Judith Enck, Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasiti, and Jennifer Burns, professor in the African American Studies Department at UAlbany. And we welcome you all to our discussion panel at WAMC.org. Alan, you were making this point right before, and I think I just want to go back. You know, we look at what happened in Buffalo, and
sure.
this was a white protester, but when this video went part of the problem that happened, and Judith, I think I'm right on this, part of the problem that happened online of why it went viral was because originally the police department said that the guy tripped and fell.
Right.
Which, you know, could only have been more absurd if they said he was going down to inspect the bunker. I just don't know. Jennifer, do you see? Are things like this, and I hope everyone understands how I use this word, but do you see these things? I mean, they're awful to look at, and they're very disturbing. But are they ultimately helpful in the sense of giving us all a sense of what it is like to be a protester and how the police are treating? Are treating the protesters?
Yes, this is common. This has been seen before. This has been complained about before. And I think, you know, Judith's point is really important, because when it comes to who the protesters are, and we can add the media in here too, the language that is used and how people of different skin colors are perceived. When you see this man and he's a white man, we have to keep in mind that there's a long history too of white on white harassment. And what I mean by that is when white people sympathize with change and ask for reform and try to create allyship, we see a long history of other white people intimidating them. And that also does happen within police forces, right?
Right.
You know, and so that right there is another component of this, that division, this long history of trying to divide black and white people who do see the problems of black and brown people and others, right, away from them through their own jobs being threatened or their families being threatened or protection for them being threatened. That's also part of this conversation. And I think that's a really important point to keep out, that that is one of the ways to break up and divide a protest.
And I, Joe, yes.
May I just ask a question of Aaron?
Yeah.
Because we're lucky to have him. He's our senior economist on our panel. And, you know, there's been much made of the way in which we have segregated our society. And the economic way becomes very, very important, because we see that on virtually every aspect of our economy, people of color suffer. Aaron, I wondered if you've been thinking about this at all.
Yeah, I have. Like I said before, the coronavirus really laid bare some of the health inequalities within our
right.
society, and that's obviously rooted to a group's economic position, whether they have access to health care, whether they can work from home or they have to go out and work on the front lines, whether they have paid sick leave, all of those affect health conditions affect your employment prospects. So, you know, in some ways, like I said, I mean, this has been bubbling under the surface for decades, if not centuries. So to the extent that, you know, the protests over the past week forced this to the surface is certainly a good thing. And I really hope that the conversation, you know, starting with, police brutality, becomes much, much wider and starts to focus on more equal opportunities, the availability of quality jobs, access to health care. All of those other issues, I hope, become a part of this debate. And, you know, the fact that it's focused on police brutality, and that's what brought it to – I mean, I shouldn't say police brutality. We should be saying murder at this point. The fact that these murders brought this conversation to a national level, that's a spark. And dealing with that is exceptionally important. I'm hoping that over – you know, the next couple years, and hopefully with the next president, that some of those more systematic inequalities that are all intertwined start to be debated, and we start to see policy reform, that equalize, wages between African Americans and other groups, unemployment rates. I could just list a litany of these things, but I'm hoping this becomes a much broader debate about racial equality and obviously class equality within our economy.
Alan, we got a letter from Margaret who says, why is Governor Cuomo denying police brutality in New York City by police with batons when there is clear evidence by video and testimony by those on the ground? He's rapidly losing any goodwill or credibility he has established over COVID-19.
Well, I'm not the spokesman for Governor Cuomo. I asked him about his relationship with the police yesterday when we were on the air. I think it was yesterday anyway. And
yep.
He made it clear that his problem was not so much with the rank and file as it was with the leadership. He's got to keep a balance here between obviously protecting people and protecting citizens, and at the same time making sure that the police understand that there are limitations on what they can do. I think it's unfair to think that this governor has anything but bad feelings about police outrageousness. I mean, he was the first guy out there yesterday when the Buffalo incident happened, right. Or he was right up there with them. So I think that, you know, we have to be very careful about our assumptions about what's motivating people.
Jennifer, any thoughts on that?
You know, I think that is true. I think we can't run with our assumptions. We really do need to find out or know, get more information and true information, not just what pops up on screens, right, that can be altered and changed. And this goes back to the point of, you know, someone who trips versus, oh, no, wait, we watch a little bit more and we really see that they were hit, right? And so I think it's looking into it more deeply and not just through one or two sources, and especially not ones that are fed to you because you viewed a few already, right, through social media and things like that. But looking deeper and asking questions and really thinking about why a person in the position they're in is doing what they're doing, and then accepting what we find when we get that information, because a lot of times we don't like what we see. We don't like the answer that it's racist or something. We need to begin to accept and embrace that so we can move into changing it and looking and asking for reform.
And that is right, of understanding it and then doing something about it. That's the next step. Judith.
Well, I think the situation that the letter writer is referring to was two nights ago in Brooklyn. And Dr. Burns is correct. You can't just see one or two things on Twitter and say, oh, this is the problem. But this was a very major event in Brooklyn where numerous reporters, incredible sources, and elected officials confirmed what happened. And that was peaceful protesters being hit with batons by NYPD. And I think the thing that surprised people was both Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio said they didn't see the videos. Millions of people saw the videos that morning. Now, the governor is super busy with COVID, which I appreciate, but those are the things that a staff person brings to the principal and say, this is probably going to come up in your news conference. And not only did the governor say he didn't see it, which I take him at his word, he didn't see it, but he did go on to say that it was impossible to imagine that police with batons would beat up peaceful protesters. Well, just not really credible. So I know the governor and the mayor have to walk a fine line. They do not want to lose support and cooperation from the police. But you got to be credible. And it's not just credible for their own reputations, but if they're is a serious problem, and I would argue there is, and part of it is the curfew in New York City, but we need our two highest elected officials rolling up their sleeves and making sure it doesn't happen a second night, a third night. But it is continuing, and we're going into a weekend where there will be more and larger protests, peaceful protests. And our elected leadership needs to deal with this today so the weekend does not repeat these scenes that we've seen all week.
Now, Judith, you did hear the governor on, and that's what I thought the letter was referring to, Buffalo. Perhaps not. I would have to hear it again. But you did hear the governor castigate the police in Buffalo for what they did in shoving this guy down, didn't you?
Yeah,
I did, and I appreciate that he called Mayor Byron Brown. I would add that Mayor Brown suspended the police. He should have fired them. That's the message that the community needs to hear when you have such a blatant act of police misconduct. Suspended? Are you kidding me?
We're going to take a break. We'll pause there. When we come back, we have a lot of letters. I want to get to those. We have other topics to discuss as well. We will do all of that right after this.
I find myself free from another.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and Jennifer Burns joining us this morning. We do have letters. Get to as many as we can before the top of the hour. We welcome yours at panel@wamc.org. Scott writes and says, welcome to today's new panel member. I'm frustrated finding some of my white acquaintances doing all sorts of twists and turns to try and make this not about race. I'm frustrated finding some of my white acquaintances doing all. A post last night said that because of the fact that the four officers involved were white, black, Hispanic, and Asian, that is proof that this is not about race. It's simply about bad policing. I'd love to hear Jennifer's reaction to this, and of course, any other panelists.
Well, what I would say is to that. Is that it very much is still about race. And it's about how race has impacted cultural ways of thinking and how our society, we know, has implicit racial components everywhere, right? So when you're saying it's not about race because one of the people who's committing a racist act is, say, another minority, it doesn't mean that their mind hasn't been influenced by racial ideologies, as everyone's in different ways in our country has. And so you see this too with, say, Trayvon Martin, right?
Right.
And the George Zimmerman situation. You see this in many other cases as well. We are a very diverse country, but we all share in this American culture, and what has been influenced or informing that culture for a very long time is, we'll say maybe for decades, the colorblind rhetoric, don't see race. And then the response, of course, is now see race. It's not bad to see race. It's bad with what you do after you see it, right? Mm-hmm. That's what can make it bad. And so I think what you're looking at is to say, how has education, how has, you know, media twisted racial things? And so people who are, say, not white still have racial ideologies in their mind and act on them as well. That's really where that answer is.
We go back to the letters. Skip and Kathy say, do you think it's an intentional, that it is intentional that some police are ignoring the vandals and targeting the protesters? The more damage that is done, the more justification for their jobs and their tactics and the more political fodder for Donald Trump. Alan?
Well, you know, the one thing I've been thinking as I sit here and I look at the crowds and see the youth of America coming out, because that's what it is, really. And I'd like to know what Dr. Burns thinks of that, because up to now, it's the same old, same old. Now, all of a sudden, we're seeing a transition where the children of America, you know, and I don't mean five-year-olds,
no.
I mean our children are going out and making a difference. And I have a feeling a lot of people's eyes got opened to all of this. I hope that Dr. Burns can talk about that demographic change a little bit.
Well, I think it's something we've seen before, right? When we look back on the 1950s and 60s, there are some things that we can take from that to learn from. One is the resistance of older people, we'll say, and a lot of leadership in the country to youth division participation. So you see that with the formation of, say, SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right? Diane Nash, John Lewis, people, you know, some who are still alive, who were that next generation, who were saying, okay, you know, we get that people have gotten maybe a few jobs here, but we see this discrimination, And we see that change is happening very slowly, if not at all. And then we see that again later on with the rise of, say, like a Black Panther Party or a Fred Hampton, and him working for it with the Rainbow Coalition, creating these ideas for economic inequality that crossed racial lines and were that next generation. And so here we are again with that next generation. I think they really need to be listened to, because typically what we look for is these major leaders to be just the face, this one leader. And what we have now is multiple leaders that are young who are telling us what they're experiencing. And they're in different parts of the country, which is so key, because we know in different states and different municipalities, there are some different laws. Some things can be the same, but how they're dealing with what's happening locally and within their state can be very different, and should be in some cases, from what's happening someplace else, even though it's around the same issue. So this younger generation really has the ability and the foresight and the thought and the bravery to be able to get out there and say, this is what we feel, this is what we see, this is what we've been taught, this is what we haven't been taught, and this is, and we want to know why we haven't been taught it, and we want to know why you're not talking about it. And I think that's a really important thing to listen to.
Joe writes to us and says, what ranks higher, a constitutional right to assemble day or night, or a local curfew? Clearly, the police in most localities seem to think the Constitution is secondary to their obsession about asserting control. Judith?
Well, I think the curfew just isn't working. There are problems with some people who are not there expressing their First Amendment rights, but a small number of people that are looting and businesses are being damaged, and that's a terrible thing. But, you know, I'm a very practical person, and I'm looking at the thousands of police officers on the streets of New York City arresting peaceful protesters who are violating their curfew. I think, and often traumatizing these protesters, I think it would be far more effective to ignore the peaceful protesters and place your police assets in areas where looting is happening. It's just going to work better. But it's kind of this self-imposed crisis. Washington, D.C., stopped the curfew. Last night, there was no curfew in Washington, D.C. In fact, the Washington, D.C. Public Works Department is out on the street right now painting giant Black Lives Matters logos on the public street in front of the White House. Good for them. But I think the curfews are making a difficult situation worse, and de Blasio and other mayors need to reconsider them on top of the issue of our constitutional right to protest.
To your immediate point, and to a point you made earlier as well, the protests, says Keith, have been going on for over a week, and I worry about this weekend. The police have been dressed up in their stupid war gear for the last week, and now they're exhausted. They've done nothing to de-escalate the situation, and in fact, they have provoked the protesters with their brutality. I fear that cities will fall to the protesters this weekend, and Trump will get exactly what he wants, which is the opportunity to call the mayors and governors weak so he can send in the military.
Including his own governor, Joe, his own mayor, Joe, in Washington, D.C.,
right,
who's made it clear she's on a different side of the street than he is. And it's interesting to watch that one play out.
It certainly is. Jennifer?
If I could just add one other thing that I'm just worried about also. I'm worried about a lot of things, but the targeting of journalists. I mean, I think this is unprecedented. Large numbers of journalists that are being beat up by police. They're allowed to be on the street when the curfew passes. I have to think that part of this is for the last 3.5 years, the police have heard journalists are enemy of the people. Police also know that journalists are chronicling what's happening in our communities. And the more journalists that experience violence at the hand of the police, I mean, that is that is quite a situation we find ourselves. I don't think we've ever been there in the United States.
Aaron, any thoughts on this?
No, I'm good.
Okay.
You know, the other thing that to Judith's point is, it's all in the First Amendment. You know, you got the journalists, mm-hmm. you got the freedom of the press, and you have the right to assemble.
Right.
Right, Judith? I mean, it's really yes. quite something that this is Trump's war on the First Amendment, no matter what he says.
I think Michael makes an interesting point. He says the protesters want to be heard. Why isn't every elected official in every city down on the streets with the protesters in dialogue with them? Where are they? It shouldn't only be up to the governors and the mayors. That's a good point.
I'll tell you where they are. They're in the land of the scared. They don't want to make a mistake, and they don't want to get unelected. And they know that there are forces at play here that could do exactly that to them. So I think that while there are certainly some who have gone out, there's no question about it. You know, they've been practicing a brand of practical politics, which is don't get into trouble if you don't have to.
Bruno writes and says, hi, gang. Alan is right. It's all about character. What kind of individual wants to be a policeman? What is the enticement? Power? And why isn't it through a thorough psych evaluation to make sure the person behind the gun and the badge will keep his cool? The recent Albany and Buffalo incidents truly demonstrated that these individuals do not have the required psychological strength to do the job.
I think we have to be very careful about painting with a broad brush. Look, there are some very good policemen. There really are some very decent people. We see them kneeling. We see them marching with the protesters. We see them understanding. And we see them of different colors, by the way. So I think we have to be I appreciate the appreciation. And I do think it's a matter of character with the bullies. But there are some very decent people in the police departments.
You know, Jennifer, you touched on this earlier, which I thought was interesting, and I didn't go back on it on the time. But in just talking about, as Alan was saying, of there are these officers who are kneeling kneeling along with the protesters. But what you said earlier was fascinating to me of the inner struggle within the police force of how those officers are treated by the other officers.
Well. Yes, right. I mean, police officers have a difficult job, and we all know that. And we should appreciate that because, you know, the point is really to protect and serve. And now, of course, we know that not everybody is being protected and served, right?
Yeah.
But it also means that there are police officers who, and some of them, like we've talked about, do not have the right character. We can use that word. Some of them also may see disparities. But if they are overwhelmed by others or by policies that really will say, you know, hate to use this term, but sort of blackball them,
yeah.
right? They don't have the protection and the backup to do their job in a different way that would be more equitable for people of color. Because of the intimidation, and their safety may be at risk when they are out there, if they have reported things that have gone on that they see within their departments that are, you know, not okay. You know, and to add to that point, too, we have to keep in mind that, so if there's a problem within the police, there should be a protocol to report that, but you're also then reporting it to the police. Right. And so that's a problem in and of itself. I think that's why we need some more of these outside investigations. Where people are not then, you know, intimidated or having to go to perhaps superiors who have been involved in the kind of behavior that these good officers see as inappropriate.
And every time you have a police complaint review board proposed in any locality, there's hell to pay.
Right.
For exactly that reason.
Let's take a break. We want to go to the news, and when we come back, we'll continue. Great conversation, and we'll continue. We welcome your letters panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and Jennifer Burns. We have letters, and I want to get to those. I do want to get to some other topics, too, and some things that are happening, which, of course, includes that the U.S. unemployment rate fell to 13.3% from 14.7%. 2.5 million jobs were added, a surprisingly positive reading in the midst of a recession that has paralyzed the economy in the wake of the viral pandemic. And so, Aaron, let us go to you for our monthly jobs report.
So this is a big whoa. The consensus estimate was a loss of another 8 million jobs with an unemployment rate close to 20%, and nobody saw this coming. So the good news is that, yes, this is moving in the right direction. Obviously, the result of a gradual reopening of the economy. Half of those 2.5 million jobs were concentrated in the restaurant industry. So it seems like the drop in unemployment has largely been due to the employers picking low-hanging fruit. What is really important to point out is that there's no guarantee that these gains are going to continue. It's been awful for 2 months now, and whether there's a second outbreak, the looting and some of the infrastructure damage that's done could cause a reversal in these numbers. But what I've been saying for a long time, and it certainly bears repeating, is that these numbers are bad. Obviously, it's the highest unemployment rate since World War II and the Great Depression. But what is worse, in my opinion, is going to be the long-term pain that the virus has had on the economy. The Congressional Budget Office just estimated earlier this week that we won't be back to pre-pandemic levels of output and employment until 2029. So it's going to be a almost decade-long crawl, a very slow, very painful crawl with the economy just operating under potential. Job growth, even though it might increase, is going to be increasing at exceptionally slow rates. We have a long, long, long ways to go before we're out of this hole, and unfortunately, it's going to be very painful. And that pain, it bears mentioning in light of what the earlier conversation we had, is not equally distributed.
Right.
So, yeah, the unemployment rate, fell to 13.3%, and it's easy to kind of get lost in the aggregate numbers. The unemployment rate for whites is 12.4%, and for blacks, it's 16.8%. So it's about 30% higher, and that's not surprising. That's been, the trend in U.S. economic history, since World War II. There's going to be long-term pain, and that pain is not going to be equally distributed.
So, Aaron, I have a question for you. It's from the Department of Paranoia. This is good news. This is good news, obviously, for Trump, right? I mean, anything that speaks to reopening of the economy, re-upping is what he's been looking for and what he wants. So do we again, from the Department of Paranoia, is there any reason to believe that these are solid figures or that there may be some hanky-panky here?
And just before you answer, Aaron, I would just like to add in to Alan's paranoia, is that the Dow is currently up over 700 points, and I know you caution us not to draw too many conclusions as a result of that, but it does go to Alan's point, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. The reason the stock market's up is that, the stock market was factoring in a loss of 8 million jobs and an unemployment rate of 20%. So that, that was factored in weeks ago. So the unexpected gain in employment, the fact that it beat estimates on the positive side is a big reason for the stock market bump. Unfortunately, I mean, I don't want to say unfortunately, but Trump can definitely point to a rising stock market and, unemployment trends that are reversing as good news, and that he was right all along, because, you know, reopening is, we don't want to, put the economy at risk. All of these things, you know, kind of bundled together in his weird, narcissistic narrative. Again, it's important to remember that the unemployment rate is still 13.3%. So yes, even though that it moved in the correct direction, it's still, higher than it's been at any point since the Great Depression. And I do want to say that I trust these numbers wholeheartedly. These numbers are calculated very consistently by civil servants at the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So I do not think with 100% or 99.9% confidence that in any way these numbers are cooked. But to that point, the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census Bureau revise their numbers over time. So buried in this morning's employment report was the fact that job losses over the last 2 months were actually, I think it was like 650,000 more jobs were lost over the past 2 months than were previously estimated. So over the next couple months, we might get a clearer picture in that these job gains might be less than intended or less than stated. But again, this doesn't in no way are we out of the woods. There's so many variables at play here now that could tilt the unemployment rate in one direction or another. And honestly, what's going to matter is what happens in September and October in the run up to the election. If the unemployment rate goes down, that's definitely a pro for Trump. If the unemployment rate picks up during September and October, that's definitely a good thing for Biden.
Well, I'd like to add another factor. Remember, the Congress provided hundreds of billions of dollars to juice the economy in the various stimulus bills. And one concern, which I think is good, but one concern, I mean, I don't think it's good that many small businesses did not get the money that they needed. But a concern is you have President Trump and his surrogates saying, see, the economy is recovering. We don't need to do another stimulus in Congress. Remember, none of that money went to the states or local governments. And so we're going, as taxpayers, we're going to be looking at either dramatic cuts in local and state services or tax increases of some kind, preferably taxing billionaires, not middle class people. But I think Trump is going to try to spin this as we don't need another federal spending bill. And Aaron, don't you think that, the fact that hundreds of billions in tax dollars was provided, doesn't that have something to do here with these changes in the jobs numbers?
Yes, yeah, that's an excellent point, Judith. That the CARES Act did. It was very large. Three times the size of the next largest stimulus mm-hmm. that Congress passed. So it had a positive impact. Allowing businesses to, retain workers as opposed to laying them off, giving consumers a little bit more purchasing power with the stimulus checks. There was the response by the Federal Reserve, which were essentially just backstopping different types of corporate loans and credit markets. So, yeah, all of these things definitely helped contain the damage. But I think the drop in unemployment is, again, half of that was due to job gains in the restaurant sector. This does give ammunition to Congress and Trump to say, hey, we don't need more stimulus. We need, more reopening. Mm-hmm. And there's obviously the public health consequences of that. Mm-hmm. You had a president in Congress who were already on the fence, if not on the side of the fence of, we don't need we don't need another stimulus, period, no matter how bad things got. The sad part is that this is exactly what the country needs. Like I said, we're talking about, you know, almost a decade of subpar growth and employment gains. And if, you know, Congress can give more juice in the form of, you know, direct federal spending on infrastructure, aid to state and local governments, that would be great. And it's really surprising that, and this goes back to Alan's point, that another round of stimulus, which, by the way, the rest of the world is doing. Japan, Germany announced massive stimuluses this week that make the, you know, relative to the size of their economy, put the U.S. to shame. Another round of stimulus would be a great short-term, you know, injection to the economy that would significantly improve Trump's chances of reelection. Just because, what, you know, whether it keeps workers on payroll or gives employers an incentive to hire workers back, gets consumer spending again. That, you know, what's in the economic interest at this point is certainly in Trump's political interest in terms of getting reelected.
Sure.
I just think you have a, you know, Republican Senate and president who are just blinded by ideology.
Alan?
Oh, yeah, well, Aaron just saved himself. Go way ahead. I was going to say, wait a second now. You know, when you say the Congress doesn't want this, the House of Representatives right. certainly does, and the Senate certainly doesn't. So you're right on the money, Aaron. Thank you.
All
I was offering a mild correction.
You're welcome.
All right, let's go to, if we can, we'll go to some letters here. Is there, Jennifer, was there anything you wanted to add to that conversation about the numbers?
No.
Okay. All right. Then let's go to letters. And Allison says, I think the pandemic with its mass unemployment is a big part of what has made it possible for young people to protest because they don't have jobs. They have the time, energy, and inclination to be politically active. I'm not sure it would be happening if everyone were fully employed. Anne says, when I was 12, 13 years old, I watched the news in disbelief as black people down south were beaten back with fire hoses, batons, and police dogs. I thought, then, this can't be happening in my country. Well, fast forward, I'm now 69 years old, and it's still happening. What could I have done then? I know what I will do now. Everything in my power to defeat this fascist in chief and his minions this November. Please be safe, says Anne.
And Joe, while we're at it, may I just do something I've been urged to do, and that is that there's going to be a gathering, let's put it that way, in front of the town hall in Great Barrington, 12 o'clock on Saturday, and people are doing signs and things of that kind. I've never seen the energy that I'm seeing, frankly, for that this time. So it's extraordinary. And yeah. I think that goes all over the place.
I agree. And you're seeing it in, I mean, even in my little village that I live in, you see it all over.
Right.
And it's really heartening. And to Judith's earlier point, it keeps going, and it doesn't seem to, it's sustained, it's peaceful. And, that is good.
Yeah, that is such a good point, both Ellen and Joe. It's certainly, we see Chicago and New York and LA, but there's also an event tonight in Williamstown, Sunday in Troy. I heard from a good friend who attended an event in Catskill yesterday. She's a very well-respected business person. She had never been to a protest in her entire life, and she went to one in Catskill, yay, where I went to high school, and closed her text to me with Black
right?
Lives Matter. I mean, this is a reckoning. This is something very different than what we've seen in the past, and that's why I'm just so interested in our political leaders convincing our police officers who are paid to serve and protect to figure out a way how to peacefully handle the peaceful protesters while doing their jobs and protecting against property damage. They can do both.
Jennifer, I'm just curious.
I agree.
Go ahead, Alan.
No, I was just going to say, I think that's a very good point. They can do both. They have to do both. And it's a very hard job, but they've got to do it right. They can't do it wrong. You push somebody down and you crack their head and you're going to pay the price. There's no two ways about it, and you should.
Jennifer, just what has your week been like the last week? I can't even imagine sort of what it's been like for you, because I assume, you know, a lot of people want your attention and help and guidance.
I will say that it's incredibly busy, and I'm going, you know, it's a twofold thing, right? All people want to know what's going on, how, you know, things feel, especially when they've been awakened to something like, oh, I knew racism exists. I didn't know how deeply entrenched it was in so many things, right?
Right.
And so, you know, they're also concerned. Are you safe? Because now there's a greater awareness for people who are Black and brown that, you know, it has awakened that you may not be safe doing a normal thing. Right? People didn't really understand that before. There's also the, can you provide us with reading? Can you provide us with information? And so in some sense, it does overburden people that are Black and brown to be the providers, when in many ways, many of us have been providing this information, trying to have conversations, sending in reform, getting organized for a very long time. So, and you know, it can be frustrating and it can be overwhelming and it's a tremendous burden, in that you're carrying it often and starting, restarting, you know, again and again when people go back to business as usual. But I will say, you know, I've talked to many of my colleagues, and many of us are emotionally trying to recharge, right? We're trying to make sure that people are able to get the information from a trusted source like us.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we really do want people who are not Black and brown to help and to really implement that help. You know, teach things in your classes, talk about them at your organizations or your jobs. Really begin to make those connections to information and not let it just go away, right? Not say, oh, okay, I'll do it for a month, but really begin to look around and continue searching for a change.
Do you hear from students, former students?
I do.
Yeah.
I do. And many of them are saying, you know, here it is. We saw
you told us this would happen.
Well, I didn't say, you know, it per se will happen. But I did say kind of a, what are you waiting for? You're now armed with this information, because what I hear from students is, why didn't people talk to us about, say, you know, Scottsboro or Emmett Till in this way, where we're able to see the gray areas and the interconnections of things? And, you know, to bring Aaron's point in, you know, to talk about this economic component a little bit more, we have to remember that in this day and age, one of the issues and these disparities in economics for Black and brown communities is the interruption of generational wealth for them for decades, right? We're familiar with sharecropping and tenant farming. Not everybody's as familiar with outside the South how housing, you know, racial covenants shape that, and people were not able to buy homes, or if they bought homes, if they were very lucky and could do that, those homes had a lower value, right? And so generational wealth is very important, because if you can't sustain jobs, if families are broken up by mass incarceration, if you have a record or a felony when you get out, and then you now can't get a job, that decade, generation after generation, that economic mobility has been harmed. And so that is also feeding into this disparity. And students see this and say, well, wait a minute. Nobody kind of presented this information where we could trace it and see it and come up to with our own conclusions about it, and then be able to start to try to find ways to reform things and to get out and vote. I think more and more young people recognize now that voting is so very important.
Can I just ask whether that, because I'm delighted to hear it, but what do you base that on? I mean, what do you think indicates that people of color will get out and vote in ways that they have never voted before?
Oh, I cannot predict that they absolutely will. But I do know for the younger generation that I have worked with, right, mm-hmm. that they have a new understanding of how critical it is, because our voting system in America, our laws and our policies and what offices you vote for and, you know, those things are very complicated. And many of the students that I've worked with for many, many years, they don't really understand the Electoral College. They don't necessarily know how it works and how it can change based on populations in different areas. You know, the terms in office of elected officials and in their state or localities all the time, who is, you know, an elected official or how they get their jobs. And so having that awareness and how that can, they can influence that process is something that more and more of them, as I'm teaching them and have been in the last few years, are starting to say, oh, wait a minute, you know, or I'm away at college. I better figure out a way to make sure I can go home or I can, you know, still vote when I'm here. And that's that, I think, is something inspiring to me, because those are the things that students don't always, or young people don't always get right away.
I hope you're right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hope I'm right, too. I keep pushing them. I'm hoping that they're going to heed that, as well as take to the streets by the feet. Right. You also have to get your feet out there and get to the poll places and register and those sort of things.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll go our last round and we'll go to the letters. We have many. We'll catch up with those. We'll be right back after the short break.
Run to me. Run to me. And I will be your partner. When you can't stand, you'll be alone. Run to me. Run to me.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enck, Aaron Pasitti, and Jennifer Burns. And we love your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We got a lot of them, so we'll get to as many as we can fit in our last 15 minutes together. John writes, my son applied to be a police officer in San Jose. He scored very high on fitness and other tests. He has a master's in sociology. He was interviewed and basically rejected because he was not considered, quote, to be tough enough for the police force. He has worked with autistic children in the past. I think this speaks volumes about the problems with police force hiring.
One wonders whether that'll change now. I mean, I think we're in a position now where a chief understands how important that kind of person is going to be on his force.
Yeah, well, as you said right before the break, I hope so, right? I mean, I hope it leads to that kind of change and an understanding. Tracy says, I'd like to hear the panel's opinion regarding the fact that the other officers involved in Mr. Floyd's murder were rookies, essentially taking orders from the more senior officer. Should that be taken into consideration? Part of the problem is that we have officers who make very bad decisions, oftentimes early in their careers, and they are given a pass and allowed to continue as officers with a slap on the wrist and change and or change in venue, only to escalate later. In the end, our police officers need just as much, if not more, training in sociology and psychology, see prior letter, as they do in physical restraint and intimidation. Thank you for taking the time to read my question. Who would like to take a swipe at that one? Judith?
Yeah, well, I think those other officers, even if they were rookies, in the words of the Minneapolis police chief, they were complicit. And a big demand of the peaceful protesters in Minneapolis was to have those other officers charged, and they were this week by Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison, who I think is an outstanding choice to do this prosecution. But I, you know, there's no question that these big police budgets need to include funding for social workers and skilled people who can de-escalate situations. Police do have a hard job, and there are good people on the police force, but if they're working in a culture where The rookie is supposed to just idly stand by while their superior officer has his knee on someone's neck. Boy, things really, really need to be reformed inside the police department. And the police cannot police themselves. I agree with Dr. Burns in saying we need outside independent reforms.
Well, right. I mean, you can be a rookie, but you can also still be a human being and be horrified by what by what is unfolding
absolutely.
In front of you.
Thank you.
One has got to assume that rookies all over the place are going to be thinking twice before they just stand by right now. They don't want to go to jail and they don't want to be fired.
Stephen has a question, two questions actually, for Jennifer, and that is, do cultural awareness and sensitivity training tests exist within police academies throughout the country? And are police officers tested for any implicit bias they may carry before and during their time on the police force? Jennifer.
I would say I would say that's complicated because it can come down to state and local ways that police forces operate, right? So they can operate differently at local levels in different places. The other thing I would say is in some places I know that they do. However, this gets back to who's designing these courses.
Right.
What information is being presented? Do people really understand the difference between implicit and explicit behavior, not just thinking, but also behavior? Is there training in how to de-escalate that on, that is molded into this conversation? And I would also say, looking back at some of the older programs that in many places have been dismantled, not nationwide, about community policing. Right. I think there is some guidance in there about community policing or about police officers and people both being invested in the communities that they're in and forming relationships, not just seeing each other in an untrustworthy way because they view each other as not invested in the area, in the people the same way.
Let's go back to letters and go to Matt, who says, does anyone on the panel agree with the idea of either defunding the police or at least disarming them? It seems to me that if they aren't all carrying guns, they might behave differently. Wouldn't cities be better off spending money on services rather than more police? I don't know how I feel about that.
I don't think that defunding the police is a good idea. I think that redistributing the funding that law enforcement gets is important. And, for years, you can kind of see this coming down from the federal level with the supplies of riot gear and the overall militarization of local police forces. I mean, you look at the pictures and they're just ready to do battle. So I don't think defunding is a good idea. I think, as Judith and Jennifer pointed out, kind of redistributing that and shifting the priorities of where that money goes into whether it's drug rehabilitation, social work, community outreach, I think that's far more important, and funding should actually be increased for those things.
But I have news for people, whether you believe defunding or redistributing is a wise policy, it's going to happen for two reasons. One is there are legislators who are unhappy with the way the police have been handling the events of the last 2 weeks. And local budgets are going to be slashed because of coronavirus impacts, and a very large chunk of local budgets go to law enforcement and pensions. So, we can exhaust ourselves with an ideological discussion, but the fiscal reality is local governments are going to be facing major budget cuts because they're, McConnell and Trump probably will not do another federal stimulus. So, get ready. This is coming.
Part of the point that Aaron was making a moment ago. Alex writes and says, forgive me for making some generalizations here. Anyone who has employed anyone knows how true the old saying is, you get what you pay for. Cutting budgets requires police departments to hire less skilled and educated employees, which with this comes a higher likelihood of violence, racism, and carelessness.
Let me tell you about the New England town meeting, which we have here in Great Barrington.
Yep.
Which, after all, is the way it's done. Chief gets up, he says, I need two more people, or I need a police dog, or I need this or that. It's amazing how there is so little in places packed, so few people willing to vote against what the chief is asking. Police have a lot of political power.
Mm-hmm. And that's among the people, too, though, right, Alan? I mean, not only the people sitting in that room who are elected, but also the town at large.
No, these are not elected. This is a town meeting citizenry.
I see.
That's what
it is.
I
get you. Oh, that's right. I forget you're in that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, forget I'm over here. Yeah,
right. Marilyn's. I'm sorry, Judith. Were you going to say something? I think I cut you off.
No.
Okay. All right.
No.
Marilyn says, any thoughts on whether white supremacists are infiltrating our police forces, getting under the radar somehow? Jennifer?
I would say yes. And that's just based on, it's an educated opinion. We'll say based on how we've seen white supremacy evolve in American history, that, you know, in some sense, it's a social club. And so this is what some people do on the side. They will have jobs, white collar jobs, blue collar jobs, and be everywhere and not, you know, announcing that they are there. So we would be fooling ourselves to think that there are not white supremacists, not only in policing, but all over the country and in political offices.
Well, they're certainly getting lots of support from the White House with Trump's statements over the years. And I might add, as Washington, D.C. is preparing for a week of President Trump is heading up to Maine.
Yes. Oh, Judith's breaking up on us. All right.
That's very hard to do.
Yes. Judith's breaking up. Okay. We'll try to recalibrate there in our few minutes left.
Is that better?
Okay. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Go ahead.
The
last thing we heard is the president is headed to Maine.
Right. To announce the largest rollback of ocean protections in history. That is how he is meeting this moment of incredible historic moment in our country. But he's plowing ahead. He's flying to Maine to announce destructive policies that will hurt our oceans. That's our president.
And there's Susan Collins, who's 9 points behind in the polls right now in her race.
Will she be meeting Air Force One at the airport?
I would doubt
probably with muffins. That's her hobby, making muffins.
Carol writes, thank you for being there. Police officers' records need to be not erased and must travel with them when they change precincts. That should be part of police reform.
Yep.
Good point. We go to Larry, who says, this is about Buffalo, to change police culture, prosecute whoever wrote and issued the press release that he tripped and fell, meaning the 75-year-old protester, and charge the person who wrote that press release with obstruction of justice until higher-ups are held responsible, it won't change.
Well, I would just add, in Buffalo, the spokesperson for the police department is the same person who is the spokesperson for the mayor. So this certainly comes close to the mayor.
Stephen writes and says, with evidence suggesting that riot police in full riot gear are having a negative effect on calming a tense situation, why not try using riot police and concealed bulletproof vests with no weapons, shields, clubs, helmets, nor anything else that looks like an outward threat? This way they look less intimidating, and without all that protective gear, they're more likely to behave in a more civil manner.
Hence Trump's thing about sending tanks to police departments.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's exactly right.
Sean says, if you defund the police, who would take care of the looters, rioters, Antifa, and the far, far right? You are missing the whole point. 99.9% of police are excellent and doing a great job protecting and serving us, says Sean. We go to Mark, who says, where is the creative thinking from the nation's leaders? How about accepting that the people have the right to protest and are going to continue to protest, and then finding ways for that to happen safely instead of setting curfews and create conflict? Instead, designate all-night protest and vigil areas and then provide police security for the people that want to attend those events, including going to and coming from the event. Officials and police are here to serve the citizens. I think I have time for one more letter, and we go to trying to find one that isn't like three pages long. That's hard. Mercedes says redirecting police funds to drug recovery and social services is defunding the police. All right, we are out of time. My thanks to everybody. Jennifer Burns, professor in African American Studies at the at SUNY Albany, thank you so much for being with us. Very nice, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you for having me, and I look forward to it, definitely.
Great. Alan, thank you. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Have a beautiful weekend. Judith and Aaron, always nice to have you on the program. We'll talk next Friday. Thank you all. We'll be back with Congressional Corner right after this.